Hi everybody, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ari. I've been sober since April 9th, 2000, and that is definitely through the grace of God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of service and service of other people to me and learning to do service at their feet. So my topic for the next 2 weeks is, I can't see through these are my reading glasses, so it's going to be a lot of off and on with the glasses. My topic for the next 2 weeks is going to be emotional sobriety, which really, at the end of the day, you know, for me, once I was able to put down the drink, and April 9th, 2000 was not my first sobriety date. It has so far been my last and continuous sobriety date. But my first sobriety date was sometime in 1987. I don't think I was serious. I was only 17. But I had a lot more after that, and it took me a while to be able to surrender, and I did it over a period of time. And, you know, I had a typical story where, you know, the longer it took, the more I lost. And it wasn't that I lost, you know, all the time material things. It was the more of myself I lost, the more of my integrity I lost, the more of my character I lost. And I certainly didn't develop any healthy coping mechanisms. I'm not here to tell my story, but I can tell you without a doubt that I qualify to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like to say I earned my seat because I believe it was a gift. I know a lot of people who didn't make it, and it's not that they didn't deserve to be here. They just, that wasn't their path, and I don't know why. And I'm not going to say, I don't like to believe in, you know, I'm going to say God for lack, because that's shorter than higher power, and you know, that's the God of your understanding at all times, of course. But I don't believe that God, you know, picks and chooses us, you know, or our names come out of a hat, that some of us get to live and some of us get to die. I just think that, you know, sometimes, honestly, that, you know, you're in the right place. I was in the right place at the right time and heard the right message enough times that when I finally had enough, I was willing to surrender enough and the right people were around me and I came in. But that really wasn't the hardest part, you know. The last time I gave up, I had sufficient desire because I had a 3-year-old daughter. I had really supportive family. I just had enough ego and pride left to not want to be more humiliated than I was. And the really hard part for me came about 18 months later. And I found myself, I have all these flags. You can see my pretty colored neon flags in my big book, because I'm going to use different passages to kind of illustrate what I'm talking about. And I think the first thing that I want to share is from We Agnostics on page 52. A lot of people know about these. If you haven't heard about them before, we call them the bedevilments. And I had these problems when I was drinking, and then I found I still had them when I was sober. And this was a big surprise to me. The context of this paragraph is, you know, basically, you know, the writers are talking about applying spiritual tools or spiritual solutions to our lives. And this paragraph comes in and says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problem the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. I had that problem sober and I had it drunk. We were a prey to misery. Oh, I'm sorry. We couldn't control our emotional natures. That got worse when I put the drink down because there was no cotton batting. There was no padding around me. There was no, you know, numbing or dumbing it down. And I couldn't turn the volume down. We were a prey to misery and depression. That got way worse when I stopped. We couldn't make a living. Well, yes, sometimes, no, sometimes. We had a feeling of uselessness. Oh, yeah. Nothing was worse for me than that feeling of not I couldn't get to the top of the world anymore. I couldn't, you know, get liquid courage. I couldn't use any other substances. And I couldn't get that feeling that I got when I just had that, like, 5 seconds of I've had just enough to drink before I'm falling down the other side. We were full of fear. Well, nothing to numb the fear. We were unhappy, yeah. And I couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. So what I had heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I heard people saying, I came to AA, I stopped drinking, my life is fabulous. And I'm like, really? What are you doing? And then I learned by reading There's a Solution, and by being taught There's a Solution, that there's different people that come to AA. There's people that come because they're moderate drinkers and they get in a little trouble because they get caught drinking and driving, or their wife or husband or boss gets upset. And then there's people who are hard drinkers with a sufficient reason they stop. And then there's people like me, real alcoholics, who I was a mess before I started drinking. I drank to solve my problems, to ease my pain, because drinking was but a symptom. And then when I stopped drinking, I was just a hot mess afterwards. I had things going on inside of me that I didn't know how to deal with without the alcohol. And that's why, I can't do the math in my head, but in 1958, Bill Wilson wrote this letter to the Grapevine, which I did look up, and it is conference-approved literature, so I'm allowed to talk about it at this group, because I checked, because I didn't want to break any rules. He wrote this letter about emotional sobriety, which came into my life a couple years into this round of my sobriety, this 23. And, well, the only 23 I've had. I've never had more than a couple years other than that. And it talked about dependence on other people and other things, and basically the things outside of my life, or outside of me, my internal life, my life with myself and my higher power, to make me not feel all those bedevilments. You know, am I making as much money as I should? Do I have the things I think I want? Are the people paying attention to me that I want to? And are things basically going my way? Or am I in a constant state of chasing and needing and wanting and trying to control all of those external things to get what I want? And as a result of that, am I miserable? I can't really be happy. I'm not really being of service to anyone because I'm constantly in selfishness and self-centeredness and self-seeking, and I don't even know it because I think that if I'm doing all the right things on the outside, I'm going to meetings and I have a sponsor and maybe I am a sponsor and I'm doing things, but my internal motives are still not right, because I'm still really not emotionally sober. And that blew my mind. In more about alcoholism, it talks about, that's a blue tab, it talks about how we are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. So, alcoholics of our kind, they're talking about real alcoholics. So, I tried a lot of things to make me not be a real alcoholic. And I'm not talking about the fact that a lot of real alcoholics, statistically, which I'm not going to quote studies because that's not AA, but statistically, a lot of alcoholics have a lot of other problems besides alcoholism. It's just a statistical fact. I have problems other than alcoholism, which I'll not talk about from this podium. But I can tell you that all of the other things that I did, therapy and self-help, because AA is not self-help, it's a spiritual program, all the other things I did for myself did not fix the things that spiritual help needed to fix. And so there's a lot of pieces of spiritual help. There's having a higher power of my own, not the one that I think I'm supposed to have that will make you happy, but the one that really sits with me. And I'll tell you what, at 23 years sober, I can tell you that my higher power, my conception of a higher power, has changed drastically in the last couple of years. because I had a thing happen. I had a thing happen that blew my mind. It changed my life. And, you know, I had a higher power, like what I like to call a sky god. I had a sky god, like a real, you know, god, like a god I grew up with. And then something happened that really blew my mind, and I couldn't make sense of it anymore. I couldn't make sense of a puppet master. And I don't want to insult anyone else's higher power or their conception, but I can tell you that this thing that rocked me, it devastated me, it put me back on my heels, and it was a real loss, it was a real trauma. And I had to go back to being a newcomer spiritually in AA, which I highly suggest, but not with a trauma. It's a wonderful thing to go back to being a spiritual newcomer in AA, because you get to go back to the beginning and have that real conversation with your sponsor and your spiritual advisors and talk about what your conception of God is. Or I say God because I'm lazy. Again, it's higher power, your higher power. And think, like, what characteristics, like, what do you believe your higher power to be? And what are you not comfortable with? Because what can you accept and what can you not accept? Because the idea of something bigger than me, just like it says in We Agnostics, the idea of God is within most of us. As most people really, I know a couple people who are true atheists and just can't get down with it, but most people are at least agnostic. They believe there's something. And over the last 3 years, because of this thing that happened in my life, and I'm happy to talk about it outside the confines of the recording, but I don't want it to be recorded. I really was able to get comfortable with the conversation that I had to go back and have the conversation with people that Bill and Ebby had, like choosing my own conception of a higher power, not worrying about what other people thought, getting really comfortable with not knowing what my higher power was, but knowing I believed there was one. And I really, it was like being new in AA all over again in order to save my life. Because it's not that I wanted to pick up a drink, but I know I can't live without a higher power, right? I know I can't. And I knew that without a higher power that I could, I don't want to say wrap my arms around, because I've always thought that a higher power is something bigger than me that I could believe in, but not necessarily completely understand, because that would be then something that was on my level, and I need my higher power to be bigger and stronger than me. It's just kind of how I roll. So I was at a loss. My whole world was upside down, and I needed my higher power to be giant and loving, and I needed this very childlike idea of a protector and a caretaker. And so emotionals, without that, that's where those bedevilments came in. Because then I was just left to my own power. And I know that lack of power is my dilemma. That's what this book tells me. It says that I have to find a power by which I can live. And I'll tell you, I spent about 6 months without any power. I was full of bedevilments and anger and resentment, and you can do that and not drink, but it isn't pretty. And it certainly isn't pretty with 19 years sober. And I had as justifiable a cause as a person could have because of what happened in my life. I had a right to be angry. I had a right to be hurt. I had a right to be resentful. When someone you love, it was a loss, someone died. When you lose someone in the terrible way that I lost someone, you have a right to be angry. And there was no one that could tell me otherwise. That was reasonable. But I didn't want to live that way. I didn't even like myself. I was like looking at myself like, ugh, I can't even stand you. Bedevilments. I was useless. I could make a living, but only because I can compartmentalize. I couldn't be helpful to anyone. My sponsees were helping me. Thank God. And finally, one day, I started over with the idea that, where is this page? I have to find you. Anyway, I thought I had it marked, but perhaps I do not. It says somewhere in this book that we have to enlarge and perfect our spiritual life. And without that, we're lost. People that don't stay sober, it tells us in here, they enlarge and perfect their spiritual life. Well, what does that mean? It means something different to everyone. Some people, and we agnostics, it talks about going back, you know, to the religion of their birth. Some people find something completely different. And I like where it says, on page 50, in our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Whether we agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. They are questions for each individual to settle for himself. And that is something I think that is so important to remember and to teach and to share with, you know, the people that are in our lives and our networks in AA, because, you know, that's it's a tradition four thing, it's an autonomy thing, but it's also a common welfare thing that I don't ever want to be. I mean, I've walked into meetings where people are really vociferous about one particular religion or faith or another. They're very open about it, and God bless them, but I know there was a time when I was young that if I walked into a meeting and people were very specific about their faith, that I might have turned around and walked out because I was not raised in that faith, and I would have felt overwhelmed or left out or marginalized, and I didn't want to be there because I felt like I didn't belong, and I already felt like I didn't belong, like anywhere at all, ever. So to walk in and hear someone say something that was very specifically of a particular religion, which is technically not what our program is about, and not just a little technically, not like the way I said it, but it is absolutely not what our program is about. It's one of the things that I wish that we were more clear about in meetings nowadays, that, you know, I guess as we get more sober and grow as people, I think it's important for me to continue to share that message. And I share that message tonight in hopes that other people remember as well that it's our job to make the newcomer feel safe and comfortable. You know, that's one way that we can continue to carry this message, is that this is a program where people create their own relationships with their higher power and shouldn't feel that they have to pick, you know, the one that everyone else has. So I love this paragraph particularly, and my very favorite paragraph in We Agnostics. and I think that right after, and I'm sorry I'm skipping around so much, but this is how my brain works, on page 52, right after the bedevilments, it says, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. So in my rebirth and my wish to come back to some emotional sobriety, because I was enjoying a very happy part of my life right up until this thing happened, and I wanted to come back to being a person that I could stand being around, which is, it's hard not to be able to stand yourself when you are with yourself 24 hours a day. And I also knew that my family was suffering, which was terrible because they suffered the same loss I did. And I, being the super good alcoholic I am, was making my suffering their suffering. Because that's how we do. You know, it's like when I get in that place, when I'm shut off from my higher power and I'm living in the bedevilments, I'm living in selfishness and self-seeking and self-centeredness, I automatically can't think about other people when I'm all about me. So on page 53, it says, we agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence, we are at pains to tell why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it more sane and logical to believe than not to believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, we don't know. When we became alcoholics, I was still alcoholic, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, well, I'll get to that in a minute, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? So, that's where I really came to a problem. I really was stumbling over this self-imposed crisis thing. I was struggling with the idea that this crisis was self-imposed. I had a hard time figuring out how something that happened that had nothing, I had nothing to do with, was a self-imposed crisis, until I realized that things happen, even horrible things happen, and it's always going to be. And I know this. I would tell sponsees this. I would tell my child this. I would tell my husband this. I would tell anybody this. The people that work for me, I would say, well, okay, this is where we are. What are we going to do about it? And I was immune to my own sound logic because of my pain and because of my fear and because of my own human frailties and because we generally can't see ourselves. We're blind. I mean, I'm blind to myself. So it took me a bit. It was a very uncomfortable 6 months for everyone who knew me and people who didn't know me because I was just a pleasure. I yelled at a lady in Trader Joe's. I would walk into the Trader Joe's in Florham Park and they would be like, oh God, she's here. Like, I mean, they would be like, oh, let's just get her out. Let's get her in and out as quick as we can. It was, I really think there was like a manager assigned to me. I'm not kidding. My self-imposed crisis was my inability to see my way out of me. And that happened because I was looking for other people and things, that trap of looking for other people and things outside of me to make me feel better. This thing happened. It's a terrible thing. It would be terrible if it happened to anyone. But no one can make me feel better. I, first of all, have to go through it. And second of all, it's between me and my higher power. That's the only way it's going to work. And since I'm having a tantrum like a 5-year-old, in Bill's emotional sobriety letter, he talks about us acting like teenagers. That would be an overestimation of my behavior. I think I was like 5 or 6, 4 maybe, and some days less. I know toddlers that behave better than I did. And thank God for the people who love me and just met me where I was at. And that's such a beautiful thing that we learn here in NAA. So our program teaches us that we get to this point, you know, and they talk in about, you know, getting to the jumping off point. You know, this was a crisis. This was a self-imposed crisis. I came to this emotional, spiritual, mental jumping off point where I was going to either pick up the mantle of, you know, sobriety and sanity and being a person, the normal kind of person I usually am to in practicing a program, or I was going to go off the deep end. And I don't know what that would have meant because the idea of drinking hadn't yet occurred to me, but man, was I like, my behavior was terrible. And I can't tell you what would have happened next because that's the nature of alcoholism. I cannot tell you if I would have packed up and run away from home. That crossed my mind. I can't tell you if I would have, you know, what kind of behavior I would have engaged in, but there were all kinds of possibilities. Hold on, I'm looking for mine. Luckily, and I kept trying to go back to my previous conception of a higher power. And I couldn't make it work. And then I was reminded that every year when I celebrate, I read this every year. For years when I celebrate, I read this from page 46 in We Agnostics. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. And soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. That's a pretty, important provided, though. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men and women. And I don't necessarily think that my higher power has a gender. And y'all are free to think anything you want about your higher power. And this book was written a really long time ago, and I know we revere it for many, many reasons. But the gender pronouns, for me, not something I love. That paragraph, to me, is the most important paragraph in this book. It is the thing that embraces everyone. It encourages everyone. It welcomes everyone. It reminds me that all I need to do is show up and my intention or my prayer only needs to be help me. Or just help. Because when I started praying again after 6 months, because I hadn't prayed, I had cursed, I had screamed, done nothing, ignored, railed. When my very first prayer, if you could call it that, my first cry was, please, I don't even know if I said please, I just said help. Help me. That's all I need to say. I just need to connect those thoughts in my head that I'm talking to something bigger than me, and even just think it, and doors open. People show up. Not necessarily who I think they'll be, but they show up. And that the idea, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. And that's not a mental idea, to earnestly seek. Earnestly seeking, to me, comes from the heart or the gut. Like, you're earnestly seeking, to me, means like desperation. Like, you really mean it. And sometimes it's even like foxhole desperation when you're new. But at that point for me, it was broken down, like sobbing, like heartbroken. I've never felt pain like this in my life. And I want to be sober. I want to be a sober woman of dignity and honor like I was before this happened. I want to behave in a way that reflects the life that I've been given as a result of being sober and doing all the things that I used to do. And I don't know how to be who I used to be. Show me what to do. And then I started to pray 4 words every day. Show me the way. Show me the way. Show me the way. And then I started saying, please. That was nice. And not long after that, I started to pray for other people again. Like everyone I could think of. My family. The people I had lost. I don't want to cry on tape. And my life started to change. And emotional sobriety started to be about... I mean, ultimately for me, emotional sobriety is about seeing what I can give and not what I can take. And that's the bottom line. And having a big life, mentally and emotionally and spiritually, is not about... It's about small actions and big intentions. And that is something that brings me all the way to the back of the book. Not the back of the 164. On page 164, in the second to last paragraph, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. That is a lot. They said a lot in those paragraphs, like a whole lot. So let's go back. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. So there's a lot of people. Well, let me talk about me. When I first came to AA and I got a big book, I don't think I actually looked at it for the first time. The first time I got a big book, I was probably 20, and I had been to treatment, which is a long and funny story that I will spare you, but I didn't go because I wanted to necessarily get sober so much as I wanted to get out of trouble, which is probably what happens to a lot of people. And that big book ended up holding up the leg of a coffee table in one of my first apartments. I did not open it for real until the last time I got back here. And I realized at 43 or so days in that I could not just drink and go to meetings. Not drink and go to meetings. Like, not drink and don't drink and go to meetings. I used to hear a lot of that back in the late 90s. And I was like, so it was right before. Like, I came in 99 and then just had a short relapse, and then 2000 was my final sobriety date. But I remember, I was like, what is this don't drink and go to meetings that they're talking about? This is like an oxymoron. If I knew how to not drink and come to meetings, I wouldn't have to come to meetings. Like, this is stupidity. Does anyone realize how stupid this is? I mean, it's a good idea, don't drink and come to meetings, but why would I need meetings if I knew how to not drink? And then I'm 43 days in, and I decide that I'm going to start taking selected suggestions because, you know, I'm very smart and I don't need to take all the suggestions, just the ones that seem interesting or whatever. But basically, I'm crawling out of my skin. I don't know what to do with myself. So I go up to this girl in a meeting, and she seems to have somewhat of her shit together. And sorry about that recording. You can dub that out. I'm like, how am I supposed to not drink and come to meetings? And I don't know. She was in the book. There weren't a ton of women in the book back then in 1999 around here. Not that I knew of anyway. And she opened up the doctor's opinion and read it with me right then and there. Actually, not far away, in Bryan Park and Summit. We left the Oaks lunchtime meeting and went to Bryan Park and Summit. And she read doctor's opinion with me, and I was mind blown. I was like, what do you mean? Like, there's other people, like, they know exactly who I am. I was mind blown. And I became more interested. I was very surprised, though, by the time I got to... I'm glad they put this in the end of the book, though, because if they said it's suggestive only, I would have never done the stuff they said. I would have been like, oh, well, I don't have to do all of it. But I do love that they say, we realize we know only a little. And I think they mean about the spiritual stuff. Because, to be honest with you, if I stopped the growth of my spiritual practice with what was in the big book, I would not be where I am now. I needed to learn more about meditation. I needed to explore other ideas of higher power. There are all kinds of things out there, and I needed help. I needed to learn how to meditate. I needed to seek other avenues of spiritual study because I needed to find what worked for me. I also had, like I said, some of us have issues other than alcoholism. I needed to seek other things out. And while the steps are the best place to start with everything, they're not always the be-all and end-all for everything. And that's what this tells me. It says we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. And I always remember hearing that story about the boat and the helicopter and the truck, the guy on the roof and the flood, that you have to take what shows up in your life and not keep saying no to the things that appear to you. You know, if people keep telling you that maybe you need to take the truck in the flood, no, I'll stay at home, and then, you know, the flood waters are rising and you say, no, I'm not going to get in the boat, and people keep offering you ways out or new options to explore, and you keep saying, no, I'm just going to keep doing this same thing, and it's 15 years later and you're still miserable, maybe do something different. I'm glad that I didn't suffer. You know, I started sponsoring this woman 5 years ago, and she had 3 years already, and she was miserable. And she had come from a different area in New Jersey, and she had never done the steps out of the big book. She had done the steps in a different way, and it didn't work for her. And we worked the steps out of the book, and she had the expected results. She used the recipe. She got the cake. And her life changed, and it's been so beautiful. And she's, you know, a big part of my life now. And watching her grow and glow and sponsor other women has been that thing they tell us, the thing we should not miss. And it's a joy. And, you know, I love walking shoulder to shoulder with her. And, you know, she got engaged last fall, and she's getting married in 35 days or something. But 2 months ago, she had a terrible loss. An unexpected, horrible loss. And to watch her go through it with such grace is, I mean, nobody does it perfect, but to do it with emotional sobriety is like, I mean, I don't want to compare myself to her because I did not do it right, but I just, there is no time. There's no sobriety age. There's no year at which you can pick up some emotional sobriety habits. You can start from day one. You can start at year 22. It's enlarging and perfecting our spiritual life always that is the thing that we need to do, that I need to do. And I didn't always do it. There are times when I like to rest on my laurels. And there are times when it's easy to slide back because life gets busy and good. You know, it's hard to remember when you're taking 3 vacations a year and your job's sailing smoothly and your kid's doing well and everything's good, that you have to stop and continue to grow spiritually and seek out ways to grow spiritually. Asking your higher power in your morning meditation what you can do for each day for the man who is still sick. Yeah, that's a big piece. How can I be of service in your world today? That was something that I struggled with because I found that at a certain point in AA, I have a strong personality in case you didn't notice yet, and it can be a turnoff. Some people don't want me to sponsor them because I'm very direct and unless they're like desperate to get better. And I have tried to change my personality, but it hasn't worked. So I don't get lots of sponsees. Also, I've gotten older and the people in AA seem to be younger. Like they come in younger, which is cool because I didn't really get like solid. I didn't solidly land until I had lost the entire decade of my 20s, which was a bummer, but, you know, it is what it is. Also, the last couple of years, you know, with the pandemic, I stopped going to in-person meetings for a while because my mom lives in my in-law suite and she's 85 now, and it was worrisome going out, and I didn't want to come home and kill her. So I thought it would be good if I went to virtual meetings and didn't bring home the plague. So it's been different. I haven't gotten any new sponsees in a couple of years, but I've definitely had the chance to build new relationships. About 5 or 6 years ago, though, I decided that I needed to start doing more for people outside of AA, and I like angled my career into an area where I was able to do well, do good for the world, and still make a living. And that has meant a lot to me because all day long I'm focused on making the world a better place, and it's not recovery based. So I don't get paid for 12-step work or anything, but I'm doing something that means a lot to me, and it keeps my head in the game, and focused on serving other people. And that's been helpful to me. I don't know if it's helpful for everyone, but I certainly think it's helpful for me. But I wasn't ready to be there until my house was in order. It wasn't something I could have taken on before I think I really hit an emotionally sober place. And it became very difficult. Thank God that this whole thing happened right as COVID hit. You know, my whole emotionally unsober phase happened right as COVID hit, and then I didn't work for almost 6 months, because if I had to work and be how I was, I don't think that I would have gotten fired. It would have been bad. Because you can't, it talks about not being able to transmit what you haven't gotten. I also wonder probably why I wasn't attracting sponsees, because other people were getting new sponsees over Zoom, is because I wasn't, you know, if it's attraction, not promotion, I was not attracting anything. People were like, my God, if she has 20 years, I don't want anything to do with that. And I remember seeing people in meetings who had much, much more time than me when I had 2 or 3 years, and thinking like, and knowing that there's a difference between time and quality of sobriety. And I don't mean quality like they're not a good person. I mean, you can have 30 days and be at peace, and you can have 30 years and not be at peace. And, you know, I know what I'm saying might be controversial, but, you know, that risk is taken whenever you invite me to speak. I feel like, you know, these words, the answer will come if your own house is in order. That's something, you know, and if you felt it, you know what I'm talking about. When you meditate and you're bringing something into your prayer and meditation life, and you're waiting to feel like you know what to do, waiting for the next right thought or answer, when it says, you know, in the step 10 part of the book, you know, pause and wait for the next right thought or action. When my house is in order, I do get, usually I know what the next right thing is. But if my house is not in order, there will be no next right thing, because the universe is waiting for me to get my house in order before I'm directed to move on, because I'm not going to move outward until I'm okay inwards. And that just makes sense, because I'm not supposed to go interact with anyone until I'm okay inside, because it's not fair to them. And it's probably not fair to me either. You know, having my relationship be right with my higher power is really about having my relationship with myself be right. It's really about, you know, people, when I first got here also, everyone was like, there were two schools. It's a selfish program. It's a selfish program was, I'm not drinking, I can do whatever I want. So that was not, though, the school of AA that I was raised in. I was raised in the call three people, ask them how you're doing, and don't talk about yourself. And then my sponsor would find out who I called and ask them if I talked about myself. And if I did, she wouldn't talk to me when I called her. Like, she was tough. And it was, you know, I think you need some water therapy. I'm like, oh, you mean like a bath? No, like scrub your toilet and scrub your mom's and go scrub someone else. Like, it was brutal. It was hard. I was raised in AA to believe that my job was to serve other people because I had been selfish for so long, to the extent that, like, I didn't know when to stop. I think that now the pendulum has swung more to the middle where self-care is okay. Like, if you're sick, you should stop and take care of yourself. If when you need to take care of yourself emotionally or physically, like, you need to do that. And it's okay to say no, like, never say no to AA. Like, I had 103 fever once in my first year and was supposed to be going to a speaking commitment. And my sponsor's like, you can stay home. It's okay. And I'm like, but you're not supposed to say no to AA. She's like, sometimes you are. So my relationship with my higher power, seeing that that relationship is right, is, am I putting the time in? Do I make time for meditation? Do I make time for prayer or intention setting, you know, at the right time for me in the day? That's always the morning. I should not speak to anyone, like, not even my dog, before I make time to do the intention setting and quiet time, because it's just, it makes all the difference. And yep, sometimes when I have a lot on my mind, I forget, and then I automatically stop whatever I'm doing, unless I'm like on a meeting at work. And I do it immediately, as soon as I can, because it changes. Like, my shoulders relax, and my whole, I can tell my face changes. Like, some of my wrinkles go away, and it's like a really good thing. I'm just checking the time because I want to be wary. And the other thing is like, there's so many tools. Like, if you can't find a comfortable way to meditate or comfortable, like, if you're not good at, you know, the meditation, like, I do breath counting, I do guided meditation, like, you'll find your place. And if you aren't finding your place, ask someone who has, and they'll help you. You know, there is no one, there's so many people in AA. Somebody's got your flavor. There is a wrench for every nut, and someone's got your flavor if you haven't gotten it yet. And I had to ask a lot of people, and you know, I used to ride the train, you know, pre-pandemic, I used to ride the train into Hoboken, and I used to listen to meditation music on the way. I'd be so zenned out by the time I got into Hoboken. People would be like, what do you, like, smoke dope on the way to work? I'm like, no, I listen to, like, sound healing meditation music, and I come in and I'm like, hey. And I work in a very stressful place, and everyone would be like, oh, what she's having. And I'd like send them a link, and they'd be like, this is what you're doing? And I'm like, yeah, 45 minutes every day. And they'd be like, wow. They didn't believe me. They thought I was kidding. But yeah, so meditation music, I mean, whatever. And for years I wrote my prayers because I couldn't focus in my head. So I'd write out my prayers in a journal. I have dozens of them. I don't have to anymore, but I used to have to because I couldn't still my mind. For years, I couldn't still my mind. It really helped me. And a couple years ago, when things got really ugly, I started writing my prayers again. Sometimes they were letters. Sometimes they were curse words. But I was told that my higher power can take it, because who am I anyway? You know, will great events come to pass for me and countless others? It depends on who you classify a great event. You know, can I sleep through a whole night again? Yeah. Can I look back and find peace? Can I sit in a moment and find peace and be at peace with myself and my situation in my life again when I lost that for a while, probably close to a year? Yeah, I can. Can I not get what I want and not try to change it right away? Yeah, I can. And can I not for a single second think that a drink is going to make it better? For many, many years now, I can. And can I not then, with the absence of not having that solution, want to kill myself? Yeah, I can make it past that thought. Because sometimes it still pops up. Because for a long time for me, it was, I'm either going to drink or I'm going to kill myself. And being able to live in my skin is the biggest miracle I've ever been given. Being able to live without guilt, without shame, to continually forgive myself for the things that I think I did that were wrong. I think that that is the, you know, that's my great fact. My great fact that I have to remember when all other things are wrong is that I am someone who woke up probably around the age of 10 until I was probably close to 40, wanted to die every day. Probably 35. I really, at some point, was like, the heaviness of what I carried was so much, because stopping drinking is great. You stop having consequences, but emotional sobriety is not needing people to love me, loving myself enough, knowing my higher power loves me enough, knowing that I am loved even if I'm not being constantly told. And it's also the idea that I can forgive myself for the things I did to get here. And even if I'm not who I, like, if I'm not, my life isn't what I thought it would be, but it's definitely better than it could have been. And it's, I don't know what it's going to be tomorrow. I mean, I haven't checked my lottery tickets. I could have won the Powerball yesterday. I don't know. I don't know if anybody won, but who knows? The thing is that I have something I never had, and I have hope. And hope is everything. You know, one of those things the bedevilment doesn't talk about, it doesn't say we have no hope. But when you're useless and you can't be, you know, helpful, and you can't make a living, and you're prey to misery and depression, I think hope is probably not in the mix. I have hope. And I have hope because I know that the realm of the spirit is welcoming me, and I know that I have a place to start my search in these steps. I know I have people who will help guide me in these rooms, and I know that at this point I've been as low as I can get, and I've found my way back sober. And that if I can do it, anybody can do it. So that's where I'm going to stop tonight. And next week, we're going to talk a little bit more about emotional sobriety and some of the tools within the steps that I have used to get there. And I guess hopefully continue to stay there, but we'll see how my week goes. Thanks very much for letting me share.